From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Exploring glasnost and perestroika on today's Fresh Air with Bill and Jane Taubman. They're both professors at Amherst College who are specialists in Soviet affairs and frequent visitors to the Soviet Union. They recently spent 6 months in Moscow living with Gorbachev's reforms. Also today, country singer and songwriter Lyle Lovett plays a few tunes and talks with us about his music. Rock historian Ed Ward profiles a man who he says personified New Orleans, Professor Longhair. And book critic John Leonard reviews John Irving's new novel, A Prayer for Owen Meany. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. Jane and William Taubman write, "The changes that Gorbachev has been bringing to the USSR and that reached a crescendo in the first 6 months of 1988 may prove to be more revolutionary than the Russian Revolution itself. We didn't think so when we arrived in Moscow in January. We did when we left in June." The Taubmans are co-authors of the new book Moscow Spring, a chronicle of their 6 months living with the changes of perestroika. The Taubmans are frequent visitors to the Soviet Union. Bill is a specialist in Soviet politics and is a professor of political science at Amherst College. Jane is an expert in Soviet literature and is an associate professor of literature at Amherst. They and their two children spent the first half of 1988 in Moscow as part of an academic exchange program between the U.S. and the Soviet Union. Although the Taubmans think that Gorbachev's reforms are revolutionary, this past Sunday's New York Times seemed to deliver a different message. In the News of the Week in Review, Bill Keller wrote, "In the jury of journalistic opinion, the verdict on Gorbachev's perestroika these days is that it has failed." I asked the Taubmans if they could reconcile these two contradictory observations.
He was referring to the economic side of perestroika, and he was saying something that is quite true, that economic conditions not only have not improved, they have in some ways gotten worse. But the economic is not the only side of perestroika. And when we talked about the potential revolutionary nature of it, we had more in mind the political side, the democratization process which is going on in the Soviet Union, and the glasnost, the openness in the press.
Mm-hmm.
I think that still has the potential to be more revolutionary than the revolution itself, in the sense that the revolution didn't change Soviet or Russian political culture. It didn't bring the democracy that it promised. And what is so exciting about what Gorbachev is attempting is that he is trying for the first time, not just in 70 years, but really in centuries, to nudge, to push, to shove the Soviet Union or Russia in the direction of democracy.
I don't know which of you is the better joke teller in the family, but I'm going to ask one of you, Jane or Bill, to tell the perestroika dog joke. This is you say it's your favorite perestroika joke.
I'm the shaggy dog expert.
Okay, give us.
The American dog turns to a Russian dog and asks, "Tell me about this perestroika of yours." The Russian dog replies wistfully, "Well, they made my chain a lot longer, and I can bark all I want, but they've moved the dinner dish a lot further away."
What's the relevance of that joke to the conditions that you found when you were in the Soviet Union?
Well, as we say in the book, glasnost is relatively easy in a country that has lots of unexpressed ideas and lots of unpublished manuscripts. But perestroika takes a lot more doing. It's going to mean fundamental changes of not only the economy, but the way people think about work and their attitude towards their work.
I think in a sense the revolution, if we can call it that, in the Soviet Union is not so much economic and not even political. It's really social and psychological. We're really talking about an attempt to change the way people think about themselves, about their fellow citizens, about their jobs. Change the way they think and they act. And in that sense, you can understand how fundamental the effort is, but also how difficult it is.
Bill, when you were trying to go to the Soviet Union this time around during the first few months of perestroika, you had trouble getting permission to stay as long as you wanted to, and you were never really sure whether they were singling you out and they didn't want you to stay that long, or whether it was just the bureaucracy, and you were just one of the people getting caught in the middle of it. Is that still typical in the Soviet Union, that you can't tell whether they're singling you out or whether the bureaucracy is just bogging down?
Well, it still happens that you can't be sure. One of the things that's changed is there are now are people in the government officialdom that you meet and talk with whom you can ask, and sometimes they'll even answer. Now, I think the man in the bureaucracy who was giving me a hard time and whom we talk about in the book, he turned out to be a kind of classic Neanderthal, a Stalinist, an anti-Semite. He would never have told me the true story, but he was replaced by much younger people who talked to me quite frankly in a way that they never would have 3 or 4 years ago and might even have answered a question about why I was being given a hard time.
If they talked to you more frankly than they could have a few years ago, what's an example of what they told you now that they couldn't have before?
Well, this doesn't concern so much me, but rather we tell the story in the book about how one day I dropped by this office where this old man had once reigned supreme and now was replaced by 3 or 4 younger people. And I walked in and found them gossiping, but it wasn't office gossip. They were talking about how many millions or how many tens of millions of people Stalin destroyed, liquidated. Now that, in the old days, I'm not sure they ever would have dared talk to each other about that, let alone discuss it in the presence of an American.
Bill, your contacts are more official contacts in the political world in the Soviet Union. Jane, you are an expert in Soviet literature, and your contacts are more in the cultural world.
Right.
What were some of the major differences you saw and what people were willing to tell you and what they were willing to write and to perform in their work?
Well, the big difference, as far as our friends were concerned on this trip, was that the differences began to blend. And indeed, we found by the end of the trip that sometimes when we got tickets to something very desirable, we would invite friends from both groups and introduce one to the other, which we never would have dreamed about doing
before. The big difference was no difference. In the old days, these groups used to be worlds apart in what they would say and certainly what they would say to us. And nowadays, they were on the same wavelength.
What was most exciting for us in this latest trip were a series of meetings, either in Bill's cases, sometimes political discussions, seminars, discussions following the showing of a new and controversial movie, or evenings devoted to the memory or in honor of a writer or singer such as Joseph Brodsky or Alexander Galich, who had emigrated, been previously non-persons.
And at these meetings, you would meet both worlds. You'd meet my friends and Jane's friends. They had crossed over and were now talking to each other as well as to us.
My guests are Bill and Jane Taubman, who are co-authors of the new book Moscow Spring, which described the 6 months from January till June that they spent in the Soviet Union. And this book describes their experiences watching perestroika unfold. Jane, you write that one of the most astonishing changes that you saw in the Soviet Union was that literary émigrés had been legitimized.
Yes. This took place just in the 6 months we were there. The first of them was Brodsky, whose poems were published for the first time in December of 87. And in the 6 months we were there, there was a flood of new names, of old names, which had been non-persons for years, coming back into the Soviet press. They're now talking about publishing Voynovich. They've published Alexander Galich. And there's a great euphoria among their former readers and fans in the Soviet Union that I would watch, sit on the subway next to a woman who was happily reading Nabokov's The Gift in Russian while strap hanging.
Is there still an underground literature?
Not very much, because there's nothing for Samizdat to print that really has not been printed in the official media, except for a few obvious exceptions, such as you read in the press the other day, Solzhenitsyn is still beyond the pale, although many journals are fighting for permission to publish his works as well.
There was a piece in this past Sunday's New York Times Sunday Book Review by Craig Whitney about glasnost writing, and he writes, imagine the freedom of being suddenly able to say the things you want to say after years of censorship. And you'll have some idea of both the excitement and the difficulty of being a writer in the Soviet Union today. Did you see that?
Precisely, and I like that article very much. He summed up exactly the predicament. Russian literature, going way back before the revolution, of course, has had to bear the burden of the kind of social discussion that has not been allowed in a more general kind of press, and it's had to do this through a Sapien language, through having readers who are well-trained to read between the lines. And now that many of those restraints are lifted, Russian writers are going to have to learn a whole new art. It's not just exciting enough to get something through and by the censor. They're going to have to decide what they're going to talk about, they'll be more free to be more individual and talk about their own personal concerns. But it's a whole new direction for Russian art, and we don't know yet how that's going to go.
Bill, one of your main projects now is a biography of Khrushchev. What's his current rating in the Soviet Union?
Well, when I think one of the reasons they hesitated to give me a visa for the whole 6 months was that they smelled out that I was interested in Khrushchev. So at that point when we arrived, he was still something of an unperson, although he'd had a couple of mentions. Now his name is everywhere. I was just back in the Soviet Union again in January at this Cuban Missile Crisis conference, and I sat down one evening with one of Khrushchev's children, and they filled me in on the current writing on Khrushchev, and I duly took notes in my notebook, and it filled two pages of references to articles about Khrushchev in the Soviet press.
What does it say that, that officials are looking more favorably on Khrushchev?
Well, Khrushchev was the great reformer, Gorbachev's great predecessor. And, of course, Khrushchev failed. And so it becomes very important for reformers to understand why Khrushchev failed in order, in part, to avoid a similar outcome this time around. So they are intently looking back to see to what extent Khrushchev came up against immovable objects, to what extent his own flaws entered into his failure. On the whole, they also want to praise Khrushchev because if you look back over the 70 years of Soviet power, there aren't that many leaders to praise. Certainly not Stalin, clearly not Brezhnev, Andropov maybe, but he didn't live long enough. Chernenko wasn't really alive when he was in power. That leaves Lenin, who of course remains sacred, or mostly so, and Khrushchev. So they have a political reason. It serves the cause of legitimizing the regime to have something good to say about Khrushchev.
You mentioned Stalin. There were debates about Stalinism when you were in the Soviet Union. Is this something new?
Well, there were not only debates. When we arrived, it was still shocking in the first few months to hear people talking about Stalin's crimes.
Comparing Stalinism occasionally to Hitlerism and fascism.
Oh, yes. That is now conventional wisdom in the Soviet Union, that Stalin and Hitler were two of a kind. By the time we left, I'd say there was a fairly broad consensus on that, but not entirely. Stalin still has his defenders, and the irony is that many of them are simple people who were Stalin's own victims and who nonetheless seem to feel a kind of nostalgia for Stalin's time.
Bill, you were asked to participate in a debate about Stalin. What kind of diplomacy do you have to use when you're an American in the Soviet Union and you want to discuss the crimes of Stalinism?
Well, that's a question that bothered me a lot at the time, that I worried over a lot. In the past, I'm frank to admit that I probably, not this time, but in previous years, had been guilty of putting things too gently, using euphemisms. And one of the things that happened last spring was that we decided to take our cue from the Russians, who were telling the truth, and to tell the truth as in unvarnished fashion as possible. So I did that on several occasions. I went in and just sort of socked it to them, talked about Stalin as I understood it. And lo and behold, on a couple of these occasions, rather than fighting back against me, I ended up being told by my Soviet listeners that I hadn't gone nearly far enough and that I'd been too soft on Stalin myself.
I found it interesting that, Bill, after you appeared on Moscow television, you were encouraged to get as much media exposure as possible because it would impress all the low-level bureaucrats that you had to deal with.
Well, the idea is that in a country like that where everybody works for the state, if the higher-ups in the state seem to be benevolent toward you, to look upon you with favor, then their underlings figure that's now the party line and they will do the same. So this was advice given to me by somebody who was really rather cynical about the way things worked, and he just wanted me to be equally cynical.
Jane, you made the rounds of some of the theaters to see what was happening, and I was surprised to read that Biloxi Blues, a Neil Simon play that was later turned into a movie in the States, was the most popular play in Moscow.
Well, it was very popular, and it was done at one of the very good new theater studios, the Tabakov Theater Studio. And I write in the book the way in which the theme of Judaism had a particular resonance for the Soviet audience, that the music, which was blues music in the American production, was replaced in the Soviet production with klezmer music, the Jewish music of Eastern Europe.
Because one of the soldiers is a Jew in the American army and is getting a hard time. And, of course, for a Soviet audience used to reading, as Jane said before, between the lines, they understood that the people who put on the play were talking about the Soviet army and also about the treatment of Jews in the Soviet Union.
And I asked someone in the theater administration the naive question, gee, why did you choose this particular play? And they looked back at me with a grin and said, we think it says some important things about the relationship of man and the army. And, of course, doing this through an American play, ostensibly about the American army in World War II, Soviet viewers who are trained to do this know exactly what they're talking about.
But this is still a sign of how far things have to go, the fact that they couldn't put on a play yet about abusive treatment of recruits in the Soviet army. They had to address that question indirectly through a Neil Simon play about the American army.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to talk with you more about the Soviet Union, but first we're going to take a short break. My guests are William and Jane Taubman, who are both Soviet experts, Bill on Soviet politics and Jane on Soviet literature. They've co-authored a new book called Moscow Spring. More after this break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
My guests are Bill and Jane Taubman, the co-authors of a new book, Moscow Spring. They're both Soviet experts, Jane in literature and Bill in political history. And they were in Moscow during 6 months from January to June of 1988. And these were six crucial months in perestroika. Let's talk about reading between the lines. You both read a lot of newspapers and magazines. You read whatever you can, I'm sure, when you're in the Soviet Union. And Jane, you had to get to the newspaper stands at, 6:30 in the morning in order to be able to pick up the newspapers you wanted?
Yes. We were quickly told that we could subscribe to things, but it took a month for our subscriptions to start. And that was a cold, long February. I tried everything, including bribing the little man who ran the kiosk. One of the ironies of Perestroika and of Glasnost and its success is that people are reading phenomenally. They're reading everything they can get their hands on, and the really interesting publications are sold out very early in the morning. I was there at 7 o'clock one morning, and sure enough, there was a line of 20 or 30 people in the pre-dawn darkness.
And they're reading in a way to see which way are things swinging, and they're reading between the lines to find it out. Yeah.
Actually, one of the big changes is that they no longer have to read between the lines.
They just have to stand on them.
Because the lines themselves are so interesting. In the old days, as Americans specializing on the Soviet Union, we knew that there wasn't much to read in the Soviet press, and you'd look for hints here and there. You'd read between the lines. Nowadays, the Soviet press is full of stories, articles that are interesting in their own right. They're not simply interesting because they tell you something about how, let's say, the Soviets feel about this or that subject. They illuminate the subject.
Well, one of the most talked about pieces while you were in the Soviet Union was by Nina Andreeva. Did I pronounce that correctly?
Nina Andreeva.
Thank you. And she's a conservative and wrote a piece condemning perestroika, and the big subject of controversy was whether the party was behind the peace or not.
Yes, her piece, which filled half a page in one of the newspapers of the Party Central Committee, seemed to many of our friends to be a signal. In the old days, it would have been a signal. What the signal they assumed it was that the reforms were finished, and that either Gorbachev was on the way out, or he himself had decided to reverse his field and retreat. And so thinking that that's what the article meant, an awful lot of people clammed up. They stopped talking. They stopped calling us. And for 3 weeks, you had a kind of preview of what may happen if and when the reforms are reversed. But luckily, this time, it was a false alarm.
And how did you know it was a false alarm?
Well, we all knew it was a false alarm because 3 weeks after the appearance of this piece, another broadside appeared, this time in the most important paper of all, Pravda, an attack on Nina Andreeva. We have a chapter in the book called Pravda to the Rescue, and our own feeling about this was highly ambivalent, because on the one hand, we were greatly reassured, as were our friends, that Pravda had re-endorsed the reforms. But on the other hand, it was not reassuring to realize that it took Pravda's re-endorsement before people dared continue to speak freely.
But the psychological results of that were very interesting. It was as if people were annoyed to look at their own fear during those 3 weeks, and the change in mood after the Pravda article was amazing.
Realizing how impotent they had been in the face of this false alarm, it was as if they took a vow to fight harder and not to be intimidated again. And so for the month or so after the Pravda piece appeared in April of 88, it was as if all hell broke loose, and suddenly the press was filled with pieces far more daring and far-reaching than any before Nina Andreeva.
Jane, it was your observation that frequently in the Soviet Union it was women who upheld the status quo during the changes of perestroika, and I think this disturbed you, and you tried to understand why this was happening.
It did puzzle me. We have a chapter in the book called Feminism? And some of it relates to Nina Andreeva. For instance, I would ask some of Bill's political friends if they thought it peculiar or interesting that it was a woman who happened to be the author of this crucial piece, and they thought, gee, no, never thought about that. At Oganyok, the most liberal magazine, we were told that up to 90% of the writers of pro-Stalinist letters were women, and I was puzzled by that and asked why they thought so, and I got a kind of semi-flip answer, longing for a strong man. And the whole question of a cut between our usual stereotypes. Women are, on the one hand, admitted to professions which we in the United States still see as masculine professions. They're chemists, they're doctors. Yet, on the other hand, there's a great conservatism, and even among the women, a great longing for more traditional roles in the family, more respect for their roles in the home, but also for men to take a stronger role in the family, and a fear that men will lose their masculinity with too much feminism.
I would imagine that in the Soviet Union now there's a lot of testing. Where are the limits? If the limits are broader than they were before, where do they lie? And how do you know if you're crossing the line? I guess you find that pretty soon if you're crossing the line.
Well, that is exciting. I used to use the metaphor of a cow standing in a field surrounded by an electric fence, that since she doesn't know she's reached it until she hits it and gets the pain, she stays a cautious way away from it. And many Soviets had done exactly that, and now they're finding where those boundaries are and finding that the boundaries in many cases aren't there at all.
Well, I would add two things. One is that it's hard to know where the limits are, and for many people who you would think would be glad that the limits are no longer clear, it's somewhat unnerving not to know where they are. And the other thing I would add is that I think many Russians, reform-minded Russians, have come to the conclusion that the limits in part depend on them, and that the bolder they are, the braver they are, the more daring they are in what they say and do, the more likely it is that the limits will be expanded. And so they're taking heart from their own courage and in the process extending the boundaries of the possible.
But the limits are not just political. For instance, the traditional near-Puritan attitudes in the Soviet press and Soviet literature on treatment of erotic themes, a much-talked-about movie, Little Vera, which came out only at the end of last year, has, as far as I know, one of the first semi-nude sex scenes in Soviet film. It's also a darn good movie without that. But many people are troubled by the falling of what they saw as worthwhile traditional boundaries, and people who see these traditional things falling are upset by the changes of perestroika.
Boris Yeltsin's campaign has been in the headlines in the American press. He's the former Moscow city party chief who lost his job over a year ago. Now he's running for office, and he's accusing the party of using dirty tricks to prevent his election. Do you think that his campaign is a sign that reform can only go so far, that he's too radical, he's more radical than the liberal reforms, and therefore they don't want him in office?
Well, we'll know the answer to that on Sunday night, or whenever the votes are counted. The elections are March 26th in the Soviet Union, and we'll see whether he wins. I have no doubt whatsoever that the party officials would like him to lose, and I have no doubt either that they have ways and means of ensuring that outcome. But on the other hand, it would be highly embarrassing, damaging for the world to conclude and for many of Yeltsin's supporters to conclude that he'd been cheated out of his rightful place in the parliament. So I think they're on the horns of a dilemma. I think they're trying to figure out what to do, and we'll know what they decided by Sunday night or Monday.
But he certainly is wildly popular among everyone we knew. Indeed, one of the first, the only Samizdat document I was given there was a copy that purported to be Yeltsin's speech at the meeting the previous fall when he had been forced out of the Politburo. Interestingly enough, Western journalists refused to publish this because they thought it was a falsification, but our Soviet friends were persuaded simply by the passionate attack on the bureaucracy that it was indeed legitimate.
Mm-hmm. We were told that kids in courtyards are playing a game called Yeltsin, in which one kid is, it's like cowboys and Indians, one kid is the fugitive, namely Yeltsin, and the other kids chase him down and try to punish him.
Have you noticed new attitudes in the United States toward the Soviet Union with glasnost?
Absolutely. It's what we call Soviet chic, and I think the cover that our publisher designed for our book typifies it. Our Moscow Spring is written out in beautiful rainbow colors, and we think back to a series of earlier books on the Soviet Union, which inevitably had lots of red and heavy brass hammer and sickles.
I think Americans want to believe the best about what's going on in the Soviet Union, and one of the paradoxes that you encounter, we encountered ourselves, is that Soviets who are themselves fighting for change were constantly telling us to lower our expectations and warning us that we might be victims of illusions. That is, the very people who are fighting for reform kept telling us, now don't put too much hope in what we're fighting for. And that was both, I think, an indication of their attitude, but also a kind of warning sign. Because if the people who are on the cutting edge of change don't have confidence in what they're doing, it risks becoming a kind of self-fulfilling prophecy.
What do you think the odds are that perestroika will bring permanent change, a more permanent openness to the Soviet Union?
Well, I think that too much of the Western and American discussion about this is polarized between those who say Gorbachev is going to succeed and those who say he's going to fail and it's going to be a disaster. You know, if people who look down the road 10 years and say either the Soviet Union is going to be a Western-style democracy or it's going to go back to Stalin. It seems to me that neither outcome is as likely as the fact that the Soviet Union in 10 years will look more or less the way it looks now. That is, changed, still changing, but neither having become like us nor having reverted back.
Okay, well, I want to thank you both very much for talking with us. Thank you.
Thank you.
And Bill and Shane Taubman's new book, Moscow Spring, is published by Summit Books. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, we'll be joined by composer and music historian Gunther Schuller, who will discuss the jazz of the swing era, and that's the subject of his new book. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Lyle Lovett's singles have made it onto the country charts, but his acerbic lyrics, big band sound, and Eraserhead hairdo have made him something of an oddball in the country music world. Coming up, Lovett plays and talks about his songs. Also, in honor of next month's New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Festival, rock historian Ed Ward profiles one of the city's most colorful and talented musicians, the late Professor Longhair. And book critic John Leonard reviews John Irving's new novel, A Prayer for Owen Meany. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Sharon Green. The Supreme Court today upheld broad drug testing programs for government employees involved in public safety and law enforcement. NPR's Nina Totenberg has details.
The court ruled on two cases. One involved the testing of railroad workers after accidents or safety violations. The other involved the testing of Customs Service employees who deal with drugs, firearms, or classified information. By a 7-2 vote, the court upheld the blood and urine testing for railroad workers, and by a 5-4 vote, the court upheld the testing for Customs Service employees. The court's two majority opinions, written by the newest justice, Anthony Kennedy, declared that in both cases, the testing was reasonable because of the government's compelling interest in ensuring public safety or the integrity of law enforcement. The railroad workers' decision had been widely expected, but the Customs Service ruling was not, particularly since only 5 employees tested positive out of 3,600 tested. The breadth of today's Customs Service ruling and the kind of testing it permits would seem to allow similar drug testing in many agencies of government. Dissenting from today's ruling in the Customs case were Justices Marshall, Brennan, Stevens, and Scalia. Scalia, the only Reagan appointee in dissent, said the Customs Service rules amounted to an immolation of privacy and human dignity. I'm Nina Totenberg at the Supreme Court.
The White House said today the use of federal troops to help fight drug-related violence in the nation's capital is unlikely. But President Bush says he has not ruled out any options, including calling out the National Guard. Spokesman Marlon Fitzwater said Bush is waiting for recommendations from Drug Policy Director William Bennett, adding that he had spoken to Bennett and was told the use of troops in Washington was not on his list for consideration. Continental Airlines officials and striking flight attendants are telling different stories about the effect on the airline of the flight attendants' walkout. Steve Hine of member station KUHF has more.
Continental Airlines claims only 138 of its 6,500 flight attendants have walked off the job, and the strike has had no effect on operations. The airline says 99.6% of its flights were on time yesterday, the first day of the job action. But the Union of Flight Attendants says many flights have been delayed because more than 1,200 flight attendants have not reported to work. Union President Carla Winkler says the airline is running out of replacements for the strikers.
Information we have received is that they are running out of their pool of people. They've canceled recurrent training down here in Houston. They've told instructors to report to the airports that they need them to fly.
Winkler says the strike's effectiveness will soon become apparent as the airline runs out of replacement flight attendants. Continental says it will fly right through the strike without interruption. For National Public Radio, I'm Steve Hine in Houston.
A Brazilian cargo plane today slammed into a crowded slum as it tried to make an emergency landing at Sao Paulo's International Airport. Latest reports say at least 18 people were killed, up to 200 were injured. Rescue workers say the death toll will rise. The plane's crew had asked for permission to land because of problems in the Boeing 707's hydraulic system. Witnesses reported hearing a loud explosion before the crash. A spokesman for Trans-Brazil Airline, which owned the plane, says it had been regularly serviced with the help of Boeing technicians. Cause of the crash is not yet known. The savings and loan industry lost a record $12 billion last year, but Federal Home Loan Bank Board President James Barth says the worst may be over. Much of 1988's lost income was old in the sense that institutions finally got around to recognizing bad loans that had long ago gone sour. About $11 billion in such non-operating losses, together with nearly $2 billion in tax payments by the industry, more than offset a modest $900 million profit on current operations. Consumer prices rose 0.4% last month. The Labor Department said the increase was kept moderate by a slight drop in clothing prices. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 3 points today to close at 2266. Advances led declines 8-5 on volume of 142 million shares. You're listening to NPR in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Professor Longhair was one of the most influential musicians in all of New Orleans. Dr. John, Alan Toussaint, Fats Domino, and Lee Dorsey were all influenced by Professor Longhair's piano style. Toussaint once called him the Bach of rock. But rock and roll historian Ed Ward says the professor's ornamentations sound more like French Baroque filtered through a dense okra gumbo.
At the end of April, New Orleans will see yet another Jazz and Heritage Festival take place, an event that's become one of the most popular music festivals in the world. It was inspired by a number of people who felt that a lot of the great New Orleans musicians weren't getting any recognition at home, and that probably one of the leading examples of that oversight was Henry Rowland Byrd, known to one and all as Professor Longhair. Fess, as he was known to some, was born in Bogalusa, Louisiana in 1918 and was well known in New Orleans as a tap dancer and a guitar player before he picked up some piano licks in the 30s. He was a natural-born hustler and worked at all kinds of things, from professional gambling to boxing, and lived such a hard life that he was discharged from the Army in the middle of World War II for reasons of health. But when the record company started coming to New Orleans in the post-war boom, Professor Longhair was ready for them. Mardi Gras in New Orleans was his first record, and it became an anthem, played continually on the radio and on jukeboxes all during Mardi Gras season, year after year. Naturally, it didn't make Fess rich. He'd signed away the rights in time-honored fashion. Anyway, there were more songs where that one came from.
Come nowhere. Oh, look at that. She ain't got nowhere. Hey, look at that. Where's that girl at?
He got his nickname from this song, which was recorded variously as Bald Head and She Ain't Got No Hair, when somebody decided that Professor Longhair would be a great name for a man singing about a bald-headed woman. How his band got stuck with the name The Shuffling Hungarians, though, is a mystery shrouded in the mists of time. Professor Longhair's trademark was a kind of rumba crossed with a blues shuffle, a rhythm that's fiendishly difficult to play on the piano, and frequently he was cursed with drummers who couldn't follow him, but occasionally the combination clicked. This so-called second-line rhythm was going to become a big thing in New Orleans rock and roll, but it was pretty avant-garde in 1953 when Fess first recorded one of his masterpieces, Tipitina, for Atlantic Records. Although his records never sold very well, Fess was recognized by other musicians as being in the great tradition of piano professors that stretched back to the days before Jelly Roll Morton. His own teachers, Archibald and Toots Washington, were seldom recorded, but such youngsters as Fats Domino and Alan Toussaint brought Fess's style into the mainstream of rock and roll. What's really odd about Professor Longhair is that after years of poverty and heavy drinking, when he was rediscovered by blues scholars in the early 70s, he was playing better than ever. This recording, made in 1971, was hot. Live, he was a revelation, and he began to tour with a new group, which he called the Blues Scholars. Young musicians would seek him out. I have a friend who took piano lessons from him for several months, and everyone agreed he personified New Orleans. Finally, somebody managed to record him with his great band, and it was announced that he'd release an album in February 1980 that would show the world how great he was. Fess probably figured his work was done, because he died in his sleep 2 days before it came out. He'd lived to see himself have his own nightclub, Tipitina's, and he'd played all over the world. And best of all, he'd left his best music behind for us all to hear.
Ed Ward is co-author of Rock of Ages, The Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll. This is Fresh Air. Meet Lyle Lovett.
Hello. I'm the guy who sits next to you and reads the newspaper over your shoulder. Wait, don't turn the page. I'm not finished. Life is so uncertain.
Here I am. Yes, it's me. Take my hand.
Here I Am is from Lyle Lovett's new album, Lyle Lovett and His Large Band. Lovett's first album came out in 1986, at a time, he says, when country music was open to a new breed, singer-songwriters who loved the genre but also loved to play with its conventions and were undeniably influenced by rock, blues, and jazz. Lovett grew up in Klein, Texas, and still lives in his hometown north of Houston. He's currently on tour with his 10-piece band. Lovett was performing at the Schubert Theater in Philadelphia, so we asked him to stop by and talk about his music. He brought his guitar, but before he played, I wanted to ask him about another track from the new album, I Married Her Just Because She Looks Like You.
It's not the words. You know I'll always love you. It's not the words I wish I could stay. It's more the way your lips look as you spoke them. How the moonlight fell upon your face. I married her just because she looks like you.
Is there a story behind the song?
Oh, just sort of. It's just one of those smart aleck kind of songs, really. You know, I really do like country music. And for me, the most of my songs start with a lyrical idea, and And that really suggests the music very quickly. And a song like I Married Her just had to be a country song, I think.
Well, it's got such a nice hook. I mean, I figured that's the line you came up with first. I married her because she looked like
yeah,
you.
Yeah, well, yeah, it was. And I actually saw somebody that reminded me a lot of somebody that I used to know.
Should I ask you about the lyric that everybody, all your reviews have quoted?
Sure.
The She's No Lady.
Oh, sure, if you want to, yeah.
Yeah, no, you want to recite the chorus?
Yeah, how about if I played it?
Sure, play it. Yeah, good.
She hates my mama. She hates my daddy, too. She loves to tell me. She hates the things I do. She loves to lie beside me almost every night. Well, she's no lady, she's my wife. The preacher asked her, and she said, I do. The preacher asked me, and she said, yes, he does too. The preacher said, I pronounce you 99 to life. Son, she's no lady, she's your wife. She's no lady, she's my wife.
Reviewers who love your records point out that song as an example as a sexist lyric. What do you think?
Oh, it's, you know, I don't hate women. I hate everybody.
Is that the pose you think of yourself as having?
No, it's just a joke. You know, that's an old joke. That's an old joke. That's an old lady, that's my wife. I mean, it's an old punchline to an old joke.
You do stand by your man on your new record. And I was wondering, why you chose to do it? It's kind of nasty when sung from a man's point of view.
Well, you know that doing that song actually came out of doing a piece for Morning Edition one time. They asked me what my favorite country song was, and I'm terrible at naming favorites, and I don't know why that popped into my mind. But I also think it works from a male point of view. It's a very 1989 kind of thing. If a man wants to be stood by in this day and time, I think he's got to ask for it.
So do you feel like you're working with stereotypes in your songs instead of upholding them yourself?
Yes. Oh, definitely. Yeah. I mean, using the stereotype to, you know, sort of propping it up to knock it down, really.
Are you considered the oddball in some country music circles?
I think so, but not in a negative way. The kind of support, I've gotten a lot of support from from other people that play country music and other performers and people in the business, almost as if they're saying, "Wow, we can't believe you're getting away with this stuff. Go, you know, keep going." They're very encouraging about it. You know?
Can I ask you to sing a chorus of one of the songs that was on your first record?
Sure.
This is a song called God Will.
Who keeps on trusting you when you've been cheating? And spending your nights on the town. And who keeps on saying that he still wants you when you're through running around? And who keeps on loving you when you've been lying, saying things ain't what they seem? God does, but I don't. God will, but I won't. That's the difference between God and me. God does, but I don't. God will, but I won't. That's the difference between God and me.
I love the arrogance of it. It's a very, very arrogant song.
Well, thank you.
Thank you very much. What kind of reaction did you get to that in country music circles? Because you manage in one song to insult the lover, religion, and to make yourself an absolute power.
Well, I guess empirically speaking, it went to 17.
That's
on the,
great,
on the Billboard
yeah.
country chart. So somewhere about a 17's worth of reaction, I guess.
I think most of your airplay has been on country stations and public radio stations.
Well, your public radio has been very good to me. You know, before I ever got a record deal, the station you're on in College Station, Texas, KAMU, used to have me on all the time, and KUT down in Austin would have me on, and playing my stuff before it was ever on records. My first nationwide exposure, really, I guess, was on country radio.
Is it hard to cross over from country?
Oh gosh, I'm not really trying to cross over. I'm just really trying to just do my songs, and I don't care where they get played, really. My producer at MCA said, "Heck, if we can't cross over, we'll cross under." So I think that's we'll sneak up on them.
Can you do another of your songs for us?
Sure. This is a song that I wrote back in 1979. That was on my second album. And as a kid, I never really could decide what I wanted to do, what I wanted to be when I grew up. So I felt that way a lot when I was in school. And so it's a song about wanting to be everything, wanting to be a cowboy, a great cowboy hero, and a sea captain all at the same time.
If I had a boat, I'd go out on the ocean. And if I had a pony, I'd ride him on my boat. And we could all together go out on the ocean and set me up on my pony on my boat. I set me up on my pony.
Singer-songwriter Lyle Lovett. His new album, Lyle Lovett and His Large Band, is on MCA Records. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is joining us from Washington, D.C. to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered. Noah, are you following the Supreme Court's ruling today on drug testing?
You bet. NPR's Nina Totenberg reports on that ruling, which says basically that the government does have the right to test customs workers for drug usage, workers who have applied for promotion, and also to test railway workers who've been involved in an accident. I'll talk with a customs agent at New York's JFK Airport who says this is definitely a violation of his Fourth Amendment rights. Also, we'll talk with Nora Bustani in Beirut about the shelling there in Lebanon, the worst in 2 years. And music critic Tom Manoff has a piece about the hot new violinist Joseph Swenson. Tom says he may have been pushed out just a bit too soon.
Thanks, Noah. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. A Prayer for Owen Meany is the latest big book from novelist John Irving. Book critic John Leonard has this review.
It's not that John Irving can't write short, dark, enigmatic modern novels for us to chew upon like crusts of dread. He did so early in his career. His first three novels altogether added up to 700 pages. The critics loved them, the public didn't. And then the fourth, The World According to Garp, all by itself weighed in at over 600 pages, and he's been a bestseller ever since. Nor is it that Garp, The Hotel New Hampshire, The Cider House Rules, or A Prayer for Owen Meany are any less 20th century intelligent for being so much more 19th century long-winded. The Cider House Rules, about orphans and abortion, was as smart as a novel can get. It's just that Irving decided to explain what he's doing while he does it, to tell the whole story and construe his own symbols as he moseys along. This 19th century spaciousness also allows him more room to be wickedly funny, even in the service of a somber purpose. Owen Meany, for instance, is a very little 11-year-old in New Hampshire in 1953. He won't get any bigger when he grows up to die, more or less because of Vietnam. He's an angel or a saint, one of the chosen, with a high-pitched scream of a voice, like Oscar in Gunter Grass's The Tin Drum. His story is told by his old friend John, a teacher of English literature to Toronto schoolgirls, a Nick Carraway to Owen's Midget Gatsby, who only believes in God because of Owen's sacrifice. Owen, you see, kills John's mother with a batted ball in a baseball game in 1953. From this awfulness, Owen goes on as the baby Jesus in a nativity pageant and the ghost of Christmas yet to come in an amateur staging of Dickens to dream the date of his own death and to seek to render himself worthy. You wouldn't think there'd be a lot of laughs in this material, and yet you laugh out loud at the nativity, even as it causes shivers. You slog along through very long chapters on Owen's prep school days to get to the bloody punchline. And because Owen's father quarries granite, you learn almost as much of rocks as Melville wanted you to know of whales, before figuring out the rock that's talked about is faith. A Prayer for Owen Meany takes religion very seriously indeed, from its beginnings in fetishism to its organization into sects to its subversive miracles. Against a universe of chance and luck, a universe up for grabs and made for television, it proposes something far more purposeful and fateful, quite as crushing as what we find in the novels of Thomas Hardy the characters are always discussing, or in the novels of Hawthorne, adulterous ministers, a sexy Hester, they seem to live inside. See Irving wink at our scramble after meanings. Even Owen's high-pitched scream is a setup for a payoff. We are trapped in a nightmare movement, from the armless totem of the Indian sagamore to the armless dressmaker's dummy of the dead mother to the armless statue of Mary Magdalene to the armless Owen in the violent air, saving the children and losing himself in the spectacular basketball dunk shot he's been practicing with John most of his short life. John finds the father he didn't want and tricks that father into faith. Owen finds the God he knew was there, abandoned by America at war. The reader, perhaps more bullied than seduced, nevertheless finds wonderment, a miracle of levitation, a bestseller with the best for sale.
John Leonard writes about television for New York Magazine, is a columnist for New York Newsday, and is media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. He reviewed A Prayer for Owen Meany by John Irving. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Australia has recently become known as the land of beer drinkers and rough-and-ready crocodile hunters. Next time, we get a very different perspective on the country from Peter Conrad. He recently returned to his childhood home in Tasmania after an absence of 20 years. He shares his memories of a people guilty and secretive about their history. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a recording of Passio by Estonian composer Arvo Pärt. It's Pärt's setting of the St. John Passion. And Egyptian-born poet Gregory Janikian reads a poem about discovering America through the songs he was taught in elementary school choir. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Naomi Person, Phyllis Myers, and Amy Sallet. Production assistants from Lisa Bruton. Research assistants from Christopher Cook. Our engineer is Thad Kirk. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.